Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Tonight on The Readout.
O.J. Simpson in a knit cap from two blocks away is still O.J. Simpson. It's no disguise. It's no disguise. It makes no sense. It doesn't fit. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
The late, great Johnny Cochran delivering the line that sealed O.J. Simpson's acquittal. Tonight, with Simpson's passing, how the trial of the century exposed every single American fault line. Also tonight, the first criminal trial of a former president begins Monday, and NBC News has obtained a list of the potential witnesses. But will Trump himself take the stand? Plus, MAGA Mike Johnson heads to Mar-a-Lago to share conspiracy theories with Trump about America's election integrity, as the RNC now officially perpetuates the big lie about the 2020 election. But we begin tonight with the end of a chapter in American history that foreshadowed and in some ways launched an era.
Nobody has more of what it takes to get you into a new LTD or other fine car faster.
It's a superstar.
Okay, that is how I experienced Orenthal James O.J. Simpson as an elementary school kid in the late 1970s, as the famous guy running through the airport to the Hertz counter. Simpson, who died today at the age of 76 from cancer, was one of the most famous Black Americans in history. And depending on your age, there's a lot of different ways you might remember him. There's O.J., the superstar running back at the University of Southern California, who won the Heisman Trophy in 1968. Or O.J. Simpson, the NFL star who played for 11 seasons and is in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Maybe it's from his time in the booth as a sports broadcaster for ABC and NBC. Or the O.J. from the movies, his most memorable role as a slapstick sidekick in all those Naked Gun flicks. But for most Americans, at this point, this is probably how you remember O.J. Simpson, from June 17, 1994.
O.J. Simpson is in that Ford Bronco with Al Cowlings.
That infamous hours-long slow speed chase down a Southern California freeway in a white Ford Bronco, as he was supposed to turn himself in, is just one of the many indelible images from O.J. Simpson's biggest imprint on American culture. The trial of the century, when the former NFL superstar was prosecuted for the double murders of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend Ron Goldman, a waiter who'd gone to her home to return some sunglasses. The chase was just one of the many moments that would become iconic. From the murders in June of 1994 in Brentwood to the beginning of Simpson's trial in November 1994 and ultimately the not guilty verdict on October 3rd, 1995. Nearly all of those moments have a through line to our current culture 29 years later. The chase interrupted regularly scheduled programming on most channels. 95 million people are said to have watched. On NBC, the NBA finals were shown picture in picture so the network wouldn't have to cut away from the chase, foreshadowing the news media frenzies for things like the Trump arraignment in Georgia last year and the insatiable American appetite for round-the-clock breaking news coverage. The O.J. trial highlighted the power of wealth and celebrity in the criminal justice system, and the impact of cameras in the courtroom. The judge in the trial, Judge Lance Ito, was said by some to be playing for the cameras. It also brought the topic of domestic violence front and center as the country learned that a favorite lovable pitchman had abused his ex-wife for years during their marriage. It introduced Americans to the concept of forensics and DNA, launching an interest that later catapulted shows like CSI and launched the concept of the celebrity lawyer. Johnny Cochran and his iconic closing argument, if it doesn't fit, you must acquit. Not to mention all the lawyers who became regulars on cable TV, Greta Van Susteren, Dan Abrams, even Savannah Guthrie. The trial had a big hand in creating a major aspect of our current celebrity culture as well. You know Kim Kardashian, but how about Robert, her late father, who was O.J. Simpson's friend and lawyer? His ex-wife, Kris Jenner, was one of Nicole Simpson's best friends. And that celebrity culture gave us another link to the present day. Back in his swinging celebrity days, O.J. Simpson traveled in the same circles as, you guessed it, Donald Trump. He attended Donald's second wedding to Marla Maples in December 1993 and told reporters, "I think everybody in the country believes maybe their relationship can work. If this relationship can work." In 2008, 13 years after Simpson was acquitted of murdering his ex-wife, Donald Trump wanted him as a contestant on Celebrity Apprentice. NBC executives unsurprisingly nixed that suggestion. But most importantly, the trial exposed toxic racial dynamics and issues around policing and police corruption that are still being felt to this day. The murders and Simpson's trial came just over 2 years after the verdict in another trial that shocked the nation in a different way, and an alleged crime caught on tape. A grainy video showing four Los Angeles police officers savagely assaulting a black man, Rodney King. Their acquittal in April 1992 sparked 6 days of deadly riots in Los Angeles and exposed wounds of division that were still raw in 1994. Amid that backdrop, the issue of race as opposed to celebrity and wealth took center stage at almost every step of the way. There was the scandal as a Time magazine cover, with a darkened shadow over Simpson's LAPD mugshot that made him look darker. There was police detective Mark Furman, who said he had found the two bloody gloves, one at the murder scene and one at Simpson's home. Jurors in the country heard tapes proving him a prolific user of the N-word, a term coined by CNN to protect their anchors from having to repeatedly say the actual hard R version, which Furman had testified under oath that he had never used. Years later, Fox News hired him as an analyst during one of Simpson's other later legal troubles. Racial tensions were so high in Southern California ahead of the verdict in Simpson's trial that ahead of that verdict, President Bill Clinton had been briefed on the possibility of assisting California authorities. And when a verdict came, the racial fault lines over the trial were laid bare, evidenced in the throngs of crowds who stopped in their tracks to hear the news on October 3rd, 1995, everywhere across the country. Here's how NBC's Nightly News reported that moment.
From a giant TV in New York's noisy Times Square to Bob's Barbershop in Oklahoma City.
Orenthal James Simpson, not guilty of a crime of murder.
To a bakery in Chicago.
Not guilty of a crime of murder.
Mostly stunned silence. But wild celebration at Howard Law School in the nation's capital.
Johnny Cochran especially did a tremendous job of putting a reasonable doubt in the jury's mind.
Joining me now is Emmy Award-winning broadcaster Ed Gordon, who got the first interview with O.J. Simpson following his acquittal. Journalist and talk show host Rolanda Watts, who was in the courtroom during the Simpson trial. And William C. Roden, award-winning contributing columnist for ESPN's Landscape. Thank you both all for being here. Rolanda, I do want to go to you first. I want to play a little soundbite because that last little sound mash that we showed of white Americans and black Americans reacting completely in diametric opposite ways to the Simpson verdict, I think is something that you touch on in this. Let's take a listen.
Many people in this country are feeling these days that the O.J. Simpson verdict has severed black and white relationships. Well, according to a recent Los Angeles Times poll, the civil verdict against O.J. determined that 71% of whites feel that O.J. is guilty, while 71% of blacks feel O.J. is not guilty.
Rolanda, you had the only talk show seat inside of the trial. Talk a little bit about that. You were a talk show host back then. I used to watch your show every day. What were these racial fault lines like? You know, why do you think they played out in such diametric opposite ways?
Well, I think it just came down to your American experience. And I think that this really polarized America, especially the verdict. But this, as you had pointed out so beautifully, we were just 2 years off of Rodney King.
That's right.
And so there was this feeling that there was finally going to be justice for a black man in court. There was finally, here was an excellent attorney defending this OJ, whatever you thought, the thought was that you were a black person in America and you understood what was happening with the police brutality, with the racism in the police department, with Furman. And it just, it really just poked at every, just like you said, every fault of American dynamics, particularly as it came to race. Even interracial marriage was a pull card there. But I tell you, it really was the race issue. And I believe it was because of the tender moment that Black America was in at that time, and to feel that justice was finally coming about. And also the fact that there was video. You know, we talk about viral moments. There weren't viral moments then, but yes, there were. The Rodney King video. Then you also had the Bloody Glove video. Mm-hmm. And you had cameras in the courtroom, which was fascinating to be part of that whole, we used to call it Camp OJ, with the scaffolding outside. And every day was just a crazy, crazy circus. But there were so many important stories that came out of this tragedy that we hope helped humanity in some way as we dealt with domestic violence and we dealt with the court system and we dealt with abuse and the police department and so many other issues that came out of that.
Indeed, indeed. And Ed Gordon, you scored that first interview in 1996. He finally does an interview and he talked to you. I want to play a little bit of that.
I can't at least find out where you were at that time. Chipping golf balls, sleep, shower.
You can find out
for $29.99.
Yeah, for $29.99.
And Ed, the book was called If I Did It. What a title. At the time as a journalist, did you believe he did it, number one? Did you believe that he is somebody who knew he did it and decided to profit off of it? What did you think of him in that interview?
Well, I will tell you that the interview in and of itself, Joy, as you might imagine, was surreal to just be a part of that. I thought you showed brilliantly how many tentacles the trial had. And it wasn't just about O.J. Simpson and these murders. It really showcased all of the racial issues that we still grapple with in this country today. I was in the office with Johnny Cochran the day he received the call to be a part of this team. Just happened by happenstance to be in the office. And so to get the interview was something that we all wanted. I believe Mr. Simpson thought that BET would be more fair than some of the other outlets. Johnny suggested to him that Ed's going to ask you, though, everything that everybody else is going to ask you. He's not going to allow you to skate. And I was cognizant that I wanted to make sure that, you know, we did that and we did that correctly. I think, though, what we saw was more about, at the end of the day, this nation than about O.J. Simpson. Mm-hmm. As you say, it opened a can of worms that we tried to tamp down, to really talk about how far we'd come in racial relations. And we just see a picture of Christopher Darden there, who was on the prosecutor's side. It was difficult even for someone like him, who was on the prosecutor's side, being vilified often by Black Americans because he was, quote unquote, going against OJ. Lastly, I would say, though, I think we have to remember, and we always talk in broad terms in instances like this, but not every African-American believed OJ Simpson was innocent. Not every African-American was jumping up and down with joy. I think the media did a disservice, as often is the case with just little short sound bites and pictures. But I think as you said earlier, I think this is one time where Black America felt like, even if you did get it, do it, you got away with it because this has been going on the other side of the coin for so very long. I think that's where the exuberance and maybe, if we want to say, the misguided joy came from.
Right. I mean, I think had Rodney King's, the man who beat Rodney King, gone to prison, you might have seen a different reaction from Black America. And, Fun fact, 10 years after that, Ed Gordon, I actually got my boss at the time, James T. Thomas, on the radio in an interview with O.J. Simpson. And I also asked him if he did it. He didn't answer me either. So just FYI, he didn't change his answer 10 years later. He still didn't answer me either. Bill Roden, the other context of O.J. really was O.J. the athlete. And I got to show this. We're not going to play it because I don't think we're allowed to play too much music on cable. But I'm not black. I'm O.J. Jay-Z immortalized that moment that we saw in that incredible documentary that talked about his history of really denying the civil rights movement his presence. And we just didn't know that. Growing up, we just thought of him as this hero, this heroic football player and this funny guy from the movies and the guy from the Hertz commercial. What do you think ultimately his legacy as regards the sports aspect of it and how much he damaged that with not just this trial and the aftermath and then getting convicted later of trying to steal his own stuff, all of it. Talk about that.
Yeah, there's so much. And again, Joy, you really laid out all of it. And I was just thinking as I was watching all of it, I was there for every phase, the USC phase, the pro phase. I first met OJ when I was 25 years old. I was a writer for Ebony Magazine, and I spent a week with him in Buffalo. And I remember, you know, we played Bid Whisk in his living on his living room floor and talking trash and all that. And to me, you know, back then I thought, well, you know, any brother who plays Bid Whisk, it can't be all bad,
right.
You know. And but the reality is that OJ was Michael Jordan before Michael Jordan. Mm. He was a crossover pitch man. He was racially neutral, made it clear he was racially neutral. And that's why I find it so ironic that, you know, when you talk about the reaction to him getting off, it really wasn't about him because he really was not, he clearly was not soul brother number one.
Right.
You know, I think it was more about Johnny Cochran and his brilliance. So I think and when you talk about his passing, I think that's what makes it so complex when these great people pass away. You know, whether it's Kobe Bryant, and we've got to deal with a lot of twists and turns and subtleties. And even with OJ, he was not this triumph. I mean, if you showed the clip of him and Donald Trump, which reminded me, so this guy, you know, so. It's, we're all talking, but there's just so much to ferret out when we're trying to, when we're trying to figure out what did his life mean?
Yeah.
And I'm still, like I said, it was just so complex, but it's about the Black experience.
Yeah.
We have a very complex relationship to this country.
Amen. We do indeed. It's a complicated story, but I am so blessed to have had these three incredible, iconic figures in their own right here to talk about it. Ed Gordon, Rolanda Watts, Bill Roden, thank you all very much. And up next on the readout, from one trial of the century to another, the first criminal trial of a former president, what we know about who is expected to take the stand. The readout continues after this.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
When the O.J. Simpson trial began in 1995, it captivated a global audience in what was essentially the first reality TV show, pulling in all the themes, celebrity, wealth, tabloid culture, and how the rich and famous can often buy their own version of criminal justice. On Monday, the same issues will be in play in another trial, one that will also capture the attention of viewers around the globe. the first criminal trial of a former U.S. president, Donald Trump. This one centered not on murder, but rather around the falsification of business records to cover up an alleged affair with an adult film star before the 2016 election. Now, let's just let that sink in for a moment. Not only is a former president facing a criminal trial for the first time in our nation's history, but this historic criminal defendant could again become the president in a matter of months. NBC News has obtained a list of the potential witnesses who could be called to testify at the trial. For the prosecution, there are names that are expected, like Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, who took out a second mortgage to pay off Stormy Daniels, who engaged in the alleged affair with Trump and then was reimbursed by Trump with a check handed to him in the Oval Office. And there's Karen McDougal, a former Playboy model who also allegedly had an affair with Trump, both at a time when third wife Melania Trump had recently given birth to Trump's fifth child. But also on the list are people who are or were part of Trump's inner circle who could corroborate Cohen's testimony, including Trump's trusted aide, Hope Hicks, Trump's longtime assistant, Ronna Graff, and former Directory of Oval Office Operations, Madeleine Westerhout. And for the defense, we know of only two potential witnesses at the moment who could take the stand, a former FEC commissioner and Donald Trump himself. Joining me now is Catherine Christian, MSNBC legal analyst and former Manhattan district assistant district attorney. I'm just going to make you the DA. I just keep on elevating you. I'm just making you. You're my DA. Let's talk about this, because it does feel like this trial will in some ways maybe be the trial of the 21st century. It's the only one that's going to probably go to trial for Trump before the election. How much of a spectacle do you think it will be?
I think it'll be a big spectacle, just the fact that it's Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Now, the first 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks are going to be boring because it's jury selection. So no witness is going to be called. Well, I'm saying it's boring, but of course, Donald Trump is going to take every opportunity he can and every break and after the cases.
Right.
Over
to
for
walk
the day,
out and talk.
Walk out and talk. But it's basically going to be like watching paint dry in that it's jury selection, which is the, I think trial lawyers will tell you, is the most important.
It is the most important thing. You win at jury selection. Yeah.
So it's very important, but it's not exciting. It's not going to be Stormy Daniels or Michael Cohen on the stand.
Well, it's not exciting to most, but I'm a nerd. It is exciting to me because I do believe voir dire and jury selection is the most important thing.
Most important part.
Because for Trump, I anticipate he's going to try to do things like have his lawyers exclude anybody black. Right? He's going to try to get them to include people who love MAGA, people who watch The Apprentice. Like, what are the kind of questions you think that his lawyers will try to ask to try to get him an ideal jury?
Well, they won't, because then, remember, the prosecutor and the defense can strike people and don't have to give reason. They have 10 each. It's called peremptory challenges.
Right.
So, and you can also challenge people for cause. So clearly someone who's like, I'm a MAGA, you know, it's...
You can exclude them for that.
Yeah, you can exclude them. In terms of them knocking people off because of their race, typically you think the prosecutor is the only one that can be challenged with that. It's called the Batson challenge.
Yeah.
There's also, in New York, defense can also be challenged. You can't, as a defense attorney,
just like everybody black,
get everyone, all the Asians off or all blacks off. So I anticipate the prosecutors making that point, too, to the judge, say, Your Honor, every single black person.
Why are they all off?
Yeah, who are normal.
Let's talk about some of these witnesses. So we're talking about, obviously, Michael Cohen, Stormy Daniels. We know that's going to be big. And Karen McDougal. We talked about them. David Pecker, I find interesting because he's the American Media CEO. So he was the one they arranged to buy the life rights from Karen McDougal to pay her off.
Catch and kill.
And they did it differently. They didn't do catch and kill through him. Yeah. In this case, Michael Cohen did it himself. How could that be an interesting witness for the prosecution?
He's very relevant because he was part of the conversations about the whole, how do we suppress this negative information? So he was very, as part of the National Enquirer.
Yeah.
So he's going to be providing the background.
Right. And let's play Karen McDougal real quick. This is her and her interview about why she sold her story.
Why do you think it was that it was after Donald Trump was the Republican nominee that they came back?
They wanted to squash the story.
You're saying they wanted to protect Donald Trump?
I'm assuming so, yeah.
You think it's because of a personal relationship with the guy who runs AMI, is friends with Donald Trump?
Correct.
And so this is how it's an election interference trial. Because
and the guy
Donald Trump's
AMI is David Pecker.
Is David Pecker. Yeah. And so, right. So the idea is they don't want the Christian right who he's trying to court to know he's a cheater.
Yeah, you want to keep it private. Because also remember at that time, the Access Hollywood.
That had come out.
Grab 'em by the you-know-what came out. So you can't have Karen McDougal, Stormy Daniels, the Access Hollywood. He was afraid, Donald Trump, that would chill his...
Yeah.
his
well, the joke's on everyone else because the so-called Christian right doesn't care. Yeah. There's also this piece that I think is very key. Michael Cohen, when he himself was sentenced, here's what it said in part of his own sentencing memo about Michael Cohen. In particular, and as Cohen himself has now admitted, with respect to both payments that he made to Stormy Daniels, he acted in coordination with and at the direction of Individual One. The fact that he was convicted, Michael Cohen, in this payoff scheme, and Individual One is Trump, that seems to me to be powerful evidence.
That's very powerful evidence. He, you know, he has baggage, Michael Cohen. But he was the fixer for Donald Trump, and he's going to testify to that. He was loyal to Donald Trump, and he's the only one who can talk about because he's the one who made the payoffs.
And also his baggage is that he went to prison
for Donald Trump.
Exactly. So his baggage actually, to me, what baggage? He's not been wrong. He said Donald Trump wouldn't leave office. He's not been wrong about that. And what baggage he has because he was doing crimes for Donald Trump. So it seems to me kind of hard to impeach him on that. But it'll be interesting to see how they try. Catherine Christian, always a pleasure. We will see you on Monday. We'll see what happens. Coming up, a major announcement from two leading election deniers. What to expect from Trump and Speaker Mike Johnson's first public event together since the MAGA disciple was elected speaker. Stay with us. Four years ago today, Donald Trump tweeted, mail-in ballots substantially increases the risk of crime and voter fraud. Which I know when you compare it to his usual unhinged, grammatically incorrect, lie-filled posts, it might seem pretty tame. But what he was doing there was setting up what would ultimately become the big lie. Around this time in 2020, Trump started to realize he might not win re-election due to how badly he bollocks to the COVID response, leading states to start passing laws letting people vote safely from home through the mail. So he began planting these seeds of mail-in election fraud in the minds of voters. And, well, we know the rest. Fast forward to today, and it looks like he's ready to once again sow doubt around the election, except this time with the help of some of his MAGA cronies. Tomorrow, Trump and House Speaker Mike Johnson, who was the leading peddler of the big lie in the House, will deliver remarks at Mar-a-Lago on, quote, election integrity. On top of that, CNN is reporting that last week, the Republican National Committee sent out a scripted call to voters saying Democrats committed massive fraud in 2020, which is just the latest example of how, under its new leadership, the RNC has devolved into a complete and utter clown show. Just this week alone, you had RNC chair election denier Michael Whatley lump in Ukraine with China and Iran when listing the United States' aggressive adversaries. While co-chair and Trump's daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, said this with a straight face.
If you want to look at a family, and I'll say a man in Donald Trump, who has had nothing but misinformation and disinformation, as they like to say on the other side of the aisle, thrown at him every single day. I mean, there's never been anyone in history, I don't think, that has taken as much incoming as Donald Trump.
Joining me now is the former chair of the RNC, Michael Steele, co-host of The Weekend here on MSNBC. I mean, McKinley, Kennedy, and Lincoln were assassinated, you know.
Right. There's that. Oh, geez. Look, your opening nailed the proposition. This has always been, and I've been giving a lot of thought based on conversations I've had with people inside and outside of the party and MAGA. There is a concerted effort that you're starting to see that's setting up the narratives for what is to come. This is not just about, you know, getting to Election Day and what they're going to roll out, whether it is, you know, threatening folks at ballot locations or gumming up the works by creating chaos and confusion in polling precincts so that they can then justify having, you know, jackleg thugs show up and, you know, all outfitted in black and looking menacing to scare off voters. It is also what comes afterwards, even with a Trump win. It is Project 2025. Yeah. It is the narrative around how the government is going to take shape under his leadership.
Yeah.
It is setting in motion all of the doubt and confusion now so that when he acts, everyone goes, oh, great, he's bringing calm and organization and structure. No, he ain't.
Yeah.
And I think that that's important for people to understand, Joy.
Eric Trump says the only purpose at this point of the RNC, let's just play him. Here's Eric Trump.
They have one objective, to get people out to the polls and to make sure that voter fraud does not happen in this country. And they will put every minute of every single day, they will use every single dime that they raise to make sure that Donald Trump is the next president of the United States and wins this upcoming election.
Except that they're going to spend most of it on his legal fees. But let me just give you a few data points for you to respond to. They're looking into the wind of Joe Biden now beating Trump in the majority of the national polls. They're looking at the Pew poll cratering all of this New York Times, CNN nonsense about this sudden movement of young people and black people toward the Republican Party. When you go by age, young people aged 18 to 29 and 30 to 49 are overwhelmingly leaning toward the Democrats. And that's whether you talk about men or women. There's no gender gap. And then it's split in 50 to 64, 65 plus. It's it's split among women. And then only a big thing for men, a big, you know, Republican advantage among men. When you go by where Democrats have wide advantages, it's women with a college degree. It's urban voters, Hispanic voters, voters born in the 1990s, Asian voters and religiously unaffiliated, and black voters. All of those are overwhelmingly advantages for Democrats. Republicans' advantages are Mormons, white voters without a college degree, veterans, rural white men, and those born in the 1940s. The group, first group I showed you are the rising group population-wise. The second group are the declining group population-wise. They know they are at a disadvantage demographically, Republicans.
Yeah.
They have not changed that, and in fact, they've made it worse. I don't care what the 900-person polls say. These are the big polls, Pew.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing to note about that Pew Research poll is that that poll was taken before the collapse under Arizona.
Yes.
Before the elevation of IVF, mm-hmm. before a whole host of things that have subsequently occurred that have further, I think, impacted those numbers.
Yes.
At the end of the day, which is why you're starting to see this narrative emerge around, oh, the Democrats, you know, are, you know, peddling in election collusion and corruption and so forth. That's, you know, again, a lot of projection. Because we know where that collusion and corruption is going to be coming from. It's not the Democrats, it's the Republicans. And yeah. and all this, oh, the voter fraud from before, well, this last election cycle, both 20 and 22, have been the most litigated and investigated for voter fraud of yes. any in our history.
That's right.
And yet, the only thing those Republicans produced, Joy, were Republicans who were convicted of voter fraud.
Correct. And voting like nine times for Trump because they were so desperate because they know there are not enough votes for him. And this is why you have to understand why he did the violence. This is why he did January 6th. He knew he lost. He was embarrassed. He knew he was going to lose in advance.
That's it.
Michael Steele, thank you. And coming up, Trump tries to con everyone about abortion, like leaving it up to the states is somehow an acceptable substitute for reproductive rights. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays will join me next. Stay with us.
It's Monday night. It's Monday, everyone. Happy to have you here on this Monday night. Lots of news to get to tonight.
Make more of your Mondays on MSNBC with Jen Psaki and Rachel Maddow back to back.
If you were talking to a voter, what would you say to them about why this case matters to them?
Was this the kind of proceeding you would expect in a typical New York DA's case, or does this really feel different?
Inside with Jen Psaki at 8 p.m. Eastern, followed by The Rachel Maddow Show at 9, Mondays on MSNBC. Monday night.
Alpha 1-9er, commence Wi-Fi device checklist.
Laptops, on. TVs, streaming. Game console, consoling. Smart thermostat, set for cuddle time. Doorbell camera, oh, my package is here.
Fast, reliable, able to power tons of devices inside your home at once.
All systems go, you are clear for takeoff.
This is Xfinity Internet, Wi-Fi built to wow. And watch the short film, The Aviators, now playing at Xfinity.com. Restrictions apply, actual speeds vary and are not guaranteed.
Donald Trump is the single solitary reason that half of America now lives in a reproductive prison. It was he who nominated three justices who lied to all of us and to the United States Senate when they promised to respect precedent, including on abortion. Stare decisis, they said. Yes, stare de perjury is more like it. But they are who they are and always were. It is because of Donald Trump that millions of women are held hostage to a minority of right-wing men. But if you listen to his lies, you would think he did a good thing.
For 52 years, people have wanted to end Roe v. Wade to get it back to the states. We did that. It was an incredible thing, an incredible achievement. We did that, and now the states have it, and the states are putting out what they want. If you're getting the will of the people, it's been pretty amazing when you think.
Yeah, well, if you listen to voters, Donald, they don't agree. In fact, they rightly blame you and Republicans for this nightmare.
I've seen so many idiotic, draconian attempts by the right-wing fascist GOP to take these steps. They want to move things backward. They want a white nationalist, right-wing fascist government.
I can't even imagine anything more horrifying than being forced to have a baby, especially if you're a child yourself. I can't even imagine that. I think it's cruel and unusual and sick.
The people who are in charge are making these rules, and we made a big mistake by not by getting Trump in office in 2020. Didn't think we were going to make this big of a mistake, but it's going to haunt us for years to come.
Yeah, that lady's right. This will haunt us for years to come because Trump and Republicans have left it up to the states. And 14 states currently have laws in effect banning nearly all abortions at conception, while Arizona and Florida currently ban abortion at 15 weeks. A statewide ban on most abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy will take effect in Florida in May. Arizona's near total ban could go into effect in 2 weeks. South Carolina and Georgia are currently the only states that ban abortion at 6 weeks when they claim cardiac activity is detected. Now, to be clear, that is a forced birth misnomer because at 6 weeks, the pregnancy is still in the embryonic stage. An embryo does not become a fetus until about 9 weeks of pregnancy. And in addition, an embryo does not have a heart at that stage of pregnancy. Nebraska and North Carolina are the two states that currently ban abortion at the 12-week mark. Utah is the only state that currently bans abortion at 18 weeks of pregnancy. Iowa bans abortion starting at 20 weeks post-fertilization. However, Iowa's Supreme Court heard arguments today on whether to allow a far more restrictive law, which would ban abortion at 6 weeks, to go into effect. And Republicans in that state are ready to drop the hammer on women if they get the green light. There are also a number of other states that have 19th century laws on the books, and Republican legislatures are ready to implement them. Wisconsin has an 1849 abortion law still on the books, which is currently the subject of a lawsuit. It will head to their Supreme Court, which has a liberal majority for now. One of their liberal justices just announced that she would be retiring in 2025, putting the liberal majority and women's rights in danger. And then there was the Comstock Act, the 1873 anti-obscenity law, which also remains on the books and which bans sending drugs or implements that could be used for abortion through the mail. Trump allies have said they plan to start enforcing it if he wins in November. And guess what? That would effectively ban abortion nationwide, no longer leaving it up to the states. So when they tell us that they've left it up to the states, they are lying to your face. It is not what they say, it's what they do. To that point, yesterday, Arizona Republicans, who claimed they didn't agree with the decision of their Supreme Court, were given an opportunity to repeal the 1864 law, but opted not to through procedural maneuvering. Their moves were met with Democratic outrage. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays, who has vowed to stand in the way of her state becoming Gilead, joins me next.
I'm 69, so we got a lot of rights during my lifetime. And to have the government try to step in and change things to the 1800s is, on the surface, ridiculous, but it's very hurtful to a lot of people.
That was just one Arizona woman who is yet another victim of the Republicans' attempt to drag us back to the dark ages. Joining me now is Arizona Attorney General Chris Mayes. Attorney General Mayes, thank you for being here. You have vowed publicly that you will not prosecute any woman or doctor under this 1864 law. But is that good enough for the women of Arizona to have to depend on you remaining in office and another Democrat being elected after you?
Hi, Joy. Thank you for having me. It's a great question. And obviously, I'm going to do everything that I can over the next 60 days, which is what we believe is the amount of time that we have to try to get something done in terms of reversing this decision or getting it overturned. I've also said, as you noted, that we will not prosecute any doctor, nurse, pharmacist, medical professional, woman under this insane, egregious law that was passed when Arizona wasn't a state. Women couldn't vote. The Civil War was still raging. Yeah. But you make a very good point, which is we have so many people in our state now who are fearful that despite my promises that I won't do that, despite the fact that I've said I'll fight any county attorney that tries to prosecute, that a court could disagree with me. Mm-hmm. And so we are in a state of chaos in essence in Arizona from a legal standpoint. And there's one guy that put us here, and that's Donald Trump.
Well, and your speaker, right? I mean, the thing is, what's so insane to me, as you said, down to Samuel Alito, they keep reaching back to the 19th century before women had the right to vote, to then say that it is that era that is when America was great, and that the law must comport to that era, except when it comes to Article 3, when it comes to insurrectionists. That one they carve out for Trump. But it does feel like a deeply misogynistic way to run a country. Your thoughts?
No, absolutely. And I think that's the what you're hearing in the voices of some of the people that you just interviewed or that the show just interviewed here in Arizona, which is this sense of disbelief that we have in Arizona that we just got dragged back to 1864. And this is why I really think, you know, this is such an enormous miscalculation by the extremists in our legislature and by these Republican judges in the Supreme Court, which is this is not a state that believes that we should be guided by or governed by an 1864 almost total abortion ban. And this is something that women and men are taking very deeply personally. And so I think it's a huge miscalculation. We are going to fight it. At the end of the day, I believe the people of Arizona are going to make their voices heard in November in the form of a ballot initiative that I believe will enshrine abortion as a constitutional right. But we have this period now between now and November where we've got to protect women. And, we're doing everything we can to do that.
Are you confident that ballot initiative will get onto the ballot without Republicans somehow stopping it?
Well, I am. I will say this, Joy. I am very confident of that. I think this decision by our Supreme Court just gave it rocket fuel. I mean, this thing was. I believed it was going to pass anyway, mm-hmm. And now I think the Supreme Court in Arizona has almost assured its passage. And I think the people of Arizona are going to make it abundantly clear that they believe in reproductive rights, that they believe in abortion access. But we are faced now with a situation, and I've been in touch with my fellow attorneys general in the West here, literally talking to the AG of California about how we can partner to help get women to California safely, how we can partner to get our abortion doctors licensed quickly in California to care for their patients in California. Just think about that.
Yeah.
How in the world did we get here?
Yeah. The other thing that was legal in 1864 was slavery. And now what you just described is an underground railroad that women in the modern era must use in order to get basic health care. God help us.
It feels that way.
Yeah. God help us. And women were essentially chattel in the 19th century. And I think there are a lot of men who would love to go back to that era. That's what they mean when they say make America great again. Attorney General Chris Mays, thank you for what you've done for the people of Arizona. And that is tonight's readout.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at msnbc.com/win.